They're tiny, excellent recyclers, great at jumping, and in large numbers, they can drive a homeowner crazy. Today, we'll talk about springtails. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. Springtails are always everywhere, but this year they seem to be a little more omnipresent. We'll find out about these tiny creatures. Horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here. He and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension will be with us in a few minutes. We're going to start the hour today in the insect world with Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
And we're going to talk about a tiny insect called the springtail today, right?
That's right. It's kind of a popular topic right now with some people, although the people who are calling asking about springtails are not pleased to have these. The rest of us have springtails. We don't notice. We don't know that we have them, but they do us a lot of benefit. So we can talk about the good springtails do. We can talk about the nuisance they create.
All right. And these are very small insects. How tiny are they?
Well, a 16th to an eighth of an inch is not tiny. They're in Iowa at about 3 mm in length. So those of you who are fluent in metric and think about holding your fingers that far apart, the rest of us are going to say, oh, about an eighth of an inch. So plainly visible to the naked eye. They're not microscopic. So small to tiny is a good word, but of course that's always relative and depends on what you think small is.
So most of us probably don't even see them.
Exactly. And since they are largely the color of dirt and shades of tan to off-white to brown to black, most people don't know they are there. Every once in a while, when you're raking back the mulch, when you pick up a leaf litter off the ground, you'll see these clusters of little tiny insects scurrying about and hopping about. Those are springtails. But until you're forced with looking at a lot of them, and especially if you have to look at them on the floor of your basement, you really don't pay much attention to them.
And where do they tend to gather? I mean, they're pretty plentiful. Where would we see them?
Well, they will be where they have food, and food is decaying organic matter and fungi, so they will be in damp locations. Now, we get wandering springtails, and they will be in the perfectly dry floor of your basement. They may be on your perfectly dry kitchen counter, but all springtails have to originate from a damp location. So in the real world, it's places like under the loose bark of dead trees where it's always moist, under the mulch, under the leaf litter, under the plant debris that accumulates on top of the ground. So they are in those perpetually moist areas where their thin-skinned little bodies can maintain a moisture content and where they find the food that they eat.
And what are they eating?
Always decaying organic matter and fungi. They are not plant feeders. They don't attack living plants. They're not carnivores. They're not bloodsuckers. They're not going to feed on us or our pets or our animals. But in those damp areas down there under the mulch, under the wood chips, where the organic matter is breaking down and decomposing, there you will find springtails helping that decomposition process along by feeding on that decaying organic matter.
And that sounds like a pretty important thing to do.
Well, we would be lost without them. They are probably one of the major contributors to recycling of the especially dead plant debris throughout our garden, throughout our fields, throughout our landscapes, that we need them. They don't need us, of course, but we need them to complete and to contribute to that cycle of breaking down old organic matter. The question is, where would we be if we didn't have insects? Well, we would be up to our armpits in dead animals and dead plants because they wouldn't be decomposing. They wouldn't decompose as fast as they do. So we need the springtails. They are contributing to the nutrient cycles in our ecosystems, and they are contributing to the breakdown of organic matter.
They tend to like moist conditions, right?
Exactly.
So why are we seeing so many of them this year?
Oh, I don't know. I wish I had a good explanation. And, of course, not everyone is seeing them. I think we should sort of emphasize that there's a lucky few people walking the earth in Iowa who are bothered by tens of thousands to millions of these. And, of course, the millions that are outside aren't the problem. It's the dozens to hundreds that have wandered into the house by accident that create the problem. So, yes, it seems backward that in a drought year we would be talking about springtails. But the springtails never go away. And one possibility is that drought tends to concentrate springtails in those few remaining damp areas. And as I think of my backyard with its nearly dead grass out in the hot sun, the springtails probably aren't there anymore. But those flower beds, those edges, those shady areas where I have been watering the hostas and watering my containers, I'm sure the springtails have done very well there, and maybe all the other springtails have moved into that area. And from there, it's not a very far hop to get into my house.
So I haven't asked you, why are they called springtails?
Well, because they have a spring for a tail. And it's not true of all springtails. There's about 8,000 different springtails in the world. Most of them, but not all of them, have a little forked tail that is attached at the tip of the abdomen. So on the underside of the abdomen, there's this little tail that's about two-thirds the length of the body. And that tail folds forward and catches into a little peg on the underside of the abdomen. And when the springtails are disturbed, that spring lets go. And it snaps them uncontrollably and tumbling into the air for a distance many times the length of their body. So because of this apparatus that helps them get around, they have a spring for a tail, and we call them springtails.
How do they stack up as far as being able to jump long distances? Do they jump as far as, say, a flea?
I think they jump farther, but the jump is really uncontrolled. The flea jumping with its legs, the grasshopper jumping with its legs, is really in a controlled motion. They are headed somewhere. They are maintaining upright. I think springtails tumble when they spring up into the air. Of course, I think it would be much more difficult to create a circus out of springtails than it would out of fleas. So I think we'll leave the fleas to the circus. And of course, the jumpers like grasshoppers go long, long distances, but the jump is aided with their wings. So that was a long answer to say I have no idea who is the champion jumper, Charity.
Right, but they jump really far.
They are very good at it. And in fact, that's the question I ask. When people call and they're trying to describe this little elongated black insect, and oftentimes they're not even sure it's an insect, they'll say, I wasn't even sure it was an insect until I saw it move. My next question is, do they hop? And the answer is, oh, yes, they do. When I get down close to them, when I poke at them with my ballpoint pen, or when I blow on them, they start hopping. And that's a very distinctive characteristic of the common springtails.
Why would they go into someone's house?
Because it's there. You know, why does the chicken cross the road? Why do we climb mountains? Why do box elder bugs wander into our house? Why do the other one, multicolored Asian lady beetles, why do they wander into the house? Because it's there. It's not purposeful. It's not based on knowledge. It's not based on prediction that the house is going to be warm and the outside is going to be cold. And in fact, springtails are incredibly disadvantaged to wander into your house, that getting indoors is a death sentence because there's not nearly enough moist areas. There's not enough moisture. They won't find a food source. They wander in. Within about 12 hours, they die of dehydration. But there was a crack or a gap. Maybe it was around the windows. Maybe it was between the siding and the foundation. Maybe it was under the door. There was a gap that just seemed like it needed to be explored, and they crawled in. And when they crawled far enough through that gap, there they are inside the house, bugging us and dying a slow, painful death.
If they make it into your house, obviously that's, to some people, kind of gross or annoying, but they're not going to do anything. They don't bite people, right?
They're annoying. They are a nuisance. They don't bite. They can't sting. They don't feed on fabrics. They don't attack the possessions within the house. They don't feed on wood unless it's very, very wet and decayed. So occasionally we may be able to raise these inside if your shower has lots of water around it that never quite dries out. If you have a sump with a sump pump that always has water in it. If they get to those areas, maybe they would reproduce, but otherwise they are completely harmless, just annoying, but something that's hopping and crawling across the kitchen counter that's not supposed to be there is the definition of pest.
What can you do to control them if they come in? I mean, they're going to die pretty quickly, so maybe you don't need to do anything.
Well, that's the that would be my attitude, but the people I talk to frequently don't share my attitude toward live and let live among the insect world.
You mean the people who feel strongly enough that they call the Iowa State University Extension entomologist are probably already a little annoyed.
They're already annoyed. They already think this is something in the wrong place. Inside, washing them up, vacuuming them up is all that's really required. However, they're going to keep coming, and that's what people object to is, I didn't mind the first dozen. I even tolerated the second dozen. It was the third through 15th dozen that I had to wipe up off the floor that becomes the problem for them. So inside, I think, just keep mechanically either vacuum or sweep them up or wash them up and discard them. Can we find a crack or gap and seal it up so they can't get in? Probably not. We cannot build a house that is going to be bug-proof enough to keep out springtails. Can we use insecticides around the outside of the house with some benefit? Probably. Spraying the threshold, spraying the gap between the foundation and siding. If you're going to use an insecticide, take it outside and try to spray where they're coming from. Now, since they're coming from under your mulch, that actually means you may have to move the mulch aside to spray that area to have the most effectiveness. But perimeter sprays will help. Now, people who live in the country are telling me they're finding millions of them moving out of CRP fields or out of hay fields, areas where there's a lot of leaf litter on the ground and the springtails have done well in spite of the dry weather. In that case, you may need to spray your yard. But remember, springtails are beneficial. We need them. Save them if you can.
All right. Donald Lewis, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. He'll be with us, of course, for the rest of the hour. Richard Geron will join us in just a moment, and they're here to answer your questions about insects or plants. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Geron is here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here, and of course, they are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start with Karen from Mount Pleasant. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Thank you for taking my call, first of all. My question is, I have two poinsettias that I've taken care of over the summer. And the leaves are beautiful. I put the smaller one in with the bigger one. And I just wondered if I, to get them to bloom for Christmas, need to put them in a dark, in our dark basement.
Mm-hmm.
Or may I leave them outside and just let them go?
Well, you can leave them outside until probably mid-September.
Mm-hmm.
Then bring them indoors. Put them in a sunny window. And then beginning October 1st, they need complete darkness from 5 p.m. until 8 a.m. each day for around 8 weeks in a row. Okay?
Okay.
You can just cover them with a box in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and then uncover them in the morning. Or you could put them in a closet, let's say at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But you have to do this every single day for about 8 weeks.
Okay.
So that's the challenge. That's the challenge, doing that every single day.
Okay. Now, they cannot live then in this climate like they do in the Himalayas.
Nope. They can grow these outdoors like in Florida, maybe the Phoenix area, maybe Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego. But in the Midwest, nope. They're not hardy at all.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Karen.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Next up, we'll go to Phyllis on the line in Davenport. Hello, Phyllis.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I have a red twig dogwood. I've had it there for quite a while, 8 or 9 years. It's always done really well. In the past, I've probably cut it back pretty severely about every third year so that the twigs would come in red. But starting about last year, I began having some dieback, and what I'd been doing is just cutting out those dead branches and mm-hmm. trying to follow the rules with dipping the clippers in bleach and all this stuff. This year, it's just doing terribly. It's just dying back branch by branch by branch. I don't know if there's any hope for it, if I should cut it way back, or if it's just going to die regardless of what I do.
Well, I would say the hot, dry summer has been a factor. This may have been a weak plant, and the hot, dry weather just made it worse and weakened the plant even further. If anything is dead, I would prune that out. If you have branches that are basically dead, there's not a single green leaf on them, I would be inclined to prune them out, but leave the rest. And then next spring, see what it does. And if there are branches that don't leaf out, they are dead, prune those out. Now, if much of the plant appears to be dead next spring, I might consider replacing it just because it's in so poor health that it may not recover.
Okay. This plant over the years has spread quite a bit. It's probably, I'm looking at it right now, it's probably 4 feet across at the base. Mm-hmm. What kind of a job might this be to actually remove this thing?
Well, it could be difficult, but on the other hand, if much of it's dead, it may not be as difficult as you might think.
Okay. Would I need to worry about getting every little bit of it out there before planting something else in there? I mean, is it likely that whatever's wrong with it is a disease that could affect the next thing I plant?
It could be disease-related, and for that reason, I would replace it with something different, maybe like, for example, a viburnum or possibly a spirea. Or possibly a forsythia, something that's different.
Right.
And so if it is a disease, they tend to be very plant-specific,
mm-hmm.
and the other plants probably should not be affected.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Phyllis. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Frank is on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Frank.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
You were talking about the springtail insect a little bit ago,
mm-hmm.
and that brought to mind a little insect that I've noticed recently in my house the last couple of months or so. It looked like a little tiny miniature flea. The thing is so tiny, you can hardly see it, and it flies around very quickly. It seems to land on white surfaces. It'll land on my drinking glass, or it'll land on the sink. It'll land on my newspaper sometime. It flies around the lamps in the light, and so quick, you can't catch it. And when I do swat it, sometimes I've killed a couple of them, but they're so quick, I can't even kill them. I'm wondering what that is and what I can do about it.
Well, since it's flying, we can rule out a lot of things. It is not springtails. Springtails are primitive insects, and they never have wings. We can rule out fleas. Fleas never have wings. So we've ruled out two. That leaves us 9,000 to go. So I'm not real sure. Tell me what you mean by tiny. Is that a 16th of an inch, an eighth of an inch, half an inch?
Oh, it's probably a 16th of an inch. They're very tiny. The largest one I think I killed, that I finally killed, was probably close to an eighth of an inch. And it looked like they might be a little bit of a tannish in color. And the ones I caught them was on the edge of my glass, and I managed to get my hand over it. and I finally squashed it, but they're so darn quick, you can't hardly catch them, and they fly around in front of my, when I'm reading the newspaper or around the light or something, or on the sink in the kitchen, and just can't seem to catch them.
And this was just recently?
Yeah, in the last month or so, a couple of months, I guess.
Okay.
I'm just wondering what they are and what I can do about them.
And do you live in a new house?
No, it's an old home.
Old house, okay. Because there is a tiny fungus beetle that fits your description, but we usually don't see a lot of those inside. And in a dry year, we wouldn't expect a lot of those to be outside as well. It doesn't sound like fruit fly, which is one of the things that people commonly have inside the house.
Well, that's what it looked like to me, because sometimes it lands on the fruit, too. And I caught it the other day on I had sliced a peach, and it landed on the peach, and I tried to get it, and it flew away, of course.
Okay.
So maybe it's a fruit fly. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm leaning that way, although fruit flies, well, I guess I didn't ask if this thing is flat or is it round, is it elongate?
No, it looks like a little tiny, it looks like a little tiny flea is what it looks like to me. It's really tiny.
Okay. Okay, you win. We're three calls in, and you have stumped us already. I don't think I'm going to come up with a name. I think we need to see this to be perfectly sure what it is. I'm guessing it's one of the little fungus beetles. They could be living in damp cracks and crevices and coming out. Or it is in the fruit fly group, which means they could be emerging from a seldom-used drain in your basement or someplace where the water is trickling through. I think a sample would be in order, and this is going to be difficult to do, but one of the things that we will allow for insects this small is to capture it on a piece of tape. Just take a piece of Scotch tape or whatever brand you have, and when you see one land, run over and gently press the tape down on top of it quickly, and then put the tape on a piece of saran wrap or a piece of plastic wrap. You know, don't fold the tape in half. Instead, leave the tape stretched out, but adhere it down. Nah, that just squashes them and gums them up too badly. And then take that to your county extension office and ask them to send it in for identification, and we'll get back to you and tell you exactly what it is.
I'll give that a try then.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you much for your time.
Thanks for your call, Frank.
All right. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Donald, you must have so much fun opening your mail.
Well, most of it is dead, at least, when it comes. Every once in a while, a box will come, and it's still scratching. It's still making noise. Those are always fun to look at. And, of course, the other option is mail has fallen off dramatically as a source of insect identification, that people now send us digital photos attached to email, which is fine as well, and we get lots of answers from that. Something in the 16th to an eighth of an inch size is not going to be easy to photograph for most of us, especially if you aren't willing to freeze it or kill it before you photograph it. You're not going to get a good picture. Things that are that small are so hard to photograph that we just tell people to go ahead and send those in. Larger insects, anything that will hold still long enough for you to take a picture, we can usually get the identification. So today's excitement, Charity, comes from opening email, not opening packages.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and horticulturist Richard Giron from ISU Extension as well. And you can join us, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Donald, this is back to the subject of springtails. This is an email from Mac in West Union. He says, a little research on the internet indicates that these are not insects. Are they or are they not? And what is the difference?
Oh, this is the kind of debate that academics with too much time on their hands have. Springtails are so primitive. There's almost nothing to them. They have been around for so long. They have six legs, but there are taxonomists, there are authorities who say they are a group just below the insects. And there are a couple of other small, primitive, insect-like critters that just don't quite reach the definition of being a true insect. So there's this, we have another term that has joined the confusion here, and that term is hexapod. Hex, of course, as in hexagons and six and so forth, and pod, as in podiatrist, leg. So there's this large group that have of animals that have six legs. The biggest group of hexapods are the insects. Then there are these other minor characters who may or may not be insects, depending on who you talk to. So the email writer is right. There are authorities who rank these below the level of insect. I think that's splitting hairs. I think that's needlessly confusing. If it's got six legs, if it walks like an insect, if it hops like an insect, let's just call them insects and be happy about it.
All right. Well, we will discontinue the debate on this program, at least. Richard, here's a question for you. This is from Roger in Des Moines. He says, I have a small patch of sunflowers that's self-seeded, which was fine for this year, but it's time to move on to something else for 2013. How do I discourage the seeds from sprouting in 2013 after removing the plants? Also, I'm thinking about throwing down hollyhock seeds this fall for next season. Does that have any chance of working?
It should, as far as the hollyhocks. As far as the sunflowers, if they don't allow them to go to seed this year, I think any seeds left from last year probably have rotted. And so I would think very few would germinate next spring.
Okay, so just cut them down before the seeds could drop.
Right, right.
All right. And the hollyhock seeds, anything special that he should
be doing? No, just kind of broadcast them and then kind of scratch them in with like a rake or something, and they should be okay.
All right. This is an email from Cheryl in Cedar Rapids. She says, I have a large 20-year-old little leaf linden shading my driveway and newly planted hosta garden. I just noticed a hole in the trunk that's about an inch and a half in diameter and about 5 feet off the ground. There is soft, rotten material on the floor of the void inside the tree. Mm-hmm. This particular linden had been attacked and defoliated by Japanese beetles for at least 8 years, yet it foliates fully each spring. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that can be done to fill the hole and seal it off? Is the rotting inside the tree a death knell for the tree?
Well, it definitely is a concern because that area may continue to grow and grow and grow. And if it does, then it weakens the trunk of the tree and it may fail in a storm. But on the other hand, the tree is going to have to deal with that as best it can by itself. There's really nothing we can do. Filling it does not do any good. Like filling it with concrete or whatever does not do any good. Painting does not do any good. So it's basically up to the tree. And I guess I would monitor the tree, and if this area continues to grow, then that's going to tell me that in some future storm, it's probably going to basically fail. It's going to fall over or break off. So,
not
unfortunate.
She also adds, by the way, I captured and killed 50 gallons of Japanese beetles from my quarter-acre yard this year.
Wow. I wonder if there's a record for that. I wonder if we could start keeping track. It was a good year for Japanese beetles. They started early. They peaked quickly. They are lingering. There's a few out there yet, but they have largely disappeared. And normally we have them up until September, and this year they are disappearing in August. But normally they start in June, and this year they started in May. So it was a good year for Japanese beetles. It's highly variable from place to place. Some people get 50 gallons in a summer. Some people might be able to get 500 gallons. And then there are those who are still new to the process who are finding five beetles and wondering what these are. So in the state, we have this really wide range of experiences. Some people have never seen a Japanese beetle. Some people have seen a few and wondered what they are. Others of us have seen more than we needed to in this lifetime and hope to never see any more again. But we know they'll be back next year.
You know, we've talked about pheromone traps and how they just attract more beetles to your property. Is there another way to capture them?
Well, I'm assuming she's using some kind of a trap. Some people use their finger and thumb, and they take out a little bucket of soapy water, and they tap them off. Japanese beetles frequently play possum, and they will pull in their legs when they are disturbed. And so you hold the cup of soapy water under the branch, you tap the branch, and the beetles fall in. So you could collect them by hand, or you could use the Japanese beetle traps if that's emotionally satisfying to you. To see all these squirming, dying, stinking beetles in the bottom of your trap, you can certainly catch a lot of beetles that way. It doesn't change the population in your yard. It doesn't change the population in your county to have caught a few hundred or 50 gallons of them, however many you've caught. But it is kind of a rewarding hobby for some.
Right. This is an email from Lucy. She says, I found a bug in the house that looks sort of like a box elder, but it's completely red. Can you tell me what it is?
It's a box elder. More and more people this year are noticing box elder bug nymphs, N-Y-M-P-H-S. Nymphs are the immature stage. All box elder bugs have a red body. The adult stage that we are familiar with has black wings that sit on top of the red body. So if you were willing to explore, you could grab a box elder bug adult, lift up its wings, and underneath you would see the red abdomen. And you will see that same red abdomen on every nymph because nymphs never have wings. So we're seeing the wingless, immature stage of the box elder bug, and more of those reported this year everywhere from on trees and sidewalks to cornfields.
Interesting. It's Horticulture Day, and we will get back to the phones after we take a quick break. You're welcome to join our conversation with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and horticulturist Richard Duran, also from Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa, and with me, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And we have a lot of people waiting on the phones with their questions. Steve is up next in Knoxville. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, it's a tomato plant question. I have beefsteaks and big boys, and they've been healthy all summer. Because I watered them almost every day. There's a lot of green, very healthy-looking foliage, and they produced a lot of tomatoes until it got cooler. And now there are green tomatoes on the plants, quite a few, and a lot of blossoms, but they just seem to have stalled out right there. They're not growing any bigger, and they're not ripening, and I'm wondering what's going on.
Well, it does take a long time for those tomatoes to grow and mature. When you have the bigger varieties like beefsteak, it takes them around 50 to 60 days for them to grow and then eventually ripen. That's a long time. The weather this summer has not been ideal. It's been too hot in many cases as far as fruit set. So in many cases, we had flowering but no fruit set. The stress is not good overall as far as fruit development. So ideally, what they'd like to have is some nice warm weather, not hot, temperatures in the day, let's say in the 70s and 80s, at night maybe in the 60s. That would be ideal. I would continue to water them probably less often. I would say if it doesn't rain every 6-7 days should be sufficient. Water them really deeply. If you have some tomatoes that appear to be rotting or whatever, pick those off and discard them. You don't want the plant wasting its energy on rotting fruit.
Right.
And hopefully they'll mature.
Well, but I did have tomatoes that did mature, that did ripen earlier, and I had quite a good crop. And then it just seems like as soon as it cooled down, they just slowed down.
And when you say slow down, meaning?
Well, the tomatoes, the plants have are really healthy looking. They have a lot of green tomatoes, but they are not growing and not ripening since it started to cool off, since there have been cooler days.
Yeah. Well, we haven't had that many cool days. I'm thinking they're just trying to get over the stress of the summer, the extreme heat. When we had temperatures in the upper 90s, 100 degrees or more, that's extremely stressful. And they're just trying to survive that. And I think with some more moderate temperatures and some moisture, then I think they'll recover some of their vigor, and those fruit will eventually go ahead and ripen.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Steve. Next up, we've got John on the line in Olwine. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Oh, thanks. What's your question?
Last fall, about a year ago, I purchased a wart-burning bush, and planted it, and it took off good last fall. And this spring, it was just wonderful up in April and up to early May. Then it started dying on one side, leaves dying, and it just kept dying down till there was no leaves left.
Mm-hmm.
The nursery said they thought I had too much water on it, which I hadn't hardly watered it at all. So I dug down beside it, probably in June, about 10 inches, and there was a good column of nice-looking healthy roots. And so I just kept watering it all summer like the rest of the plants. About 2 weeks ago, it shot three or four nice leaves on top, and something ate those off. But the stems are still, like, green and alive, but the rest of the plant has no leaves on it.
Okay. Well, it doesn't sound very good. I don't think the prognosis is good. What I would do is I would continue to water on a weekly basis if it's dry, and I would do that through September, October, into November, and then maybe put some chicken wire fencing around it this fall so the rabbits can't get it over winter, and then see what it does next spring. And if it leaves out nicely, looks to be good, fine. If it's just barely alive, I might just choose to replace it at that point. But I would give it a chance and see what it does next spring. That, to me, is the key. What does it do next spring?
Okay. Well, I was just wondering because the nursery or nobody else had any ideas either. So
well,
I called the experts.
Yeah. The burning bush, for the most part, has few serious insect and disease problems. So we normally don't see a big problem there. You can overwater if you water too often and you keep the ground saturated. And if you do that, some of the roots will basically drown, which is not good. So a nice deep watering once a week should be sufficient, I would say.
All right, John.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Dale on the line in Linn County. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. I got no bug problems, thankfully, at least that I'm aware of. So this one's for Richard. I've got a pretty good-sized asparagus patch, and it's on the tail end of the garden. Of course, the asparagus being the perennial thing or whatever, I don't know if that mm-hmm. was a good move or not, you know, with regard to tractors and turning around and tilling and this and that or whatever. But I guess my question is, what is the effectiveness of using I guess the old-fashioned way of what I've understand to be the old-fashioned way of controlling weeds and asparagus was that they're supposed to be salt tolerant and that you salt the ground or whatever to keep the weeds down. And I don't want to poison the ground or sterilize the ground if that's not ultimately going to be quite effective. What's your thoughts on the whole salt on asparagus bed thing?
Right. That used to be a common practice years ago. It is true that asparagus is somewhat salt tolerant. But if you put it on heavily enough, it will also damage the asparagus. So we don't recommend
okay.
it. We suggest manual labor, basically, hoeing and pulling. And when you hoe, it should be quite shallow so you don't damage the actual asparagus crowns or roots. But if you do that on a regular basis and keep ahead of the weeds, that should be effective. Now, if you have a really tough weed, maybe like quack grass in the bed. One way to deal with that is to basically wait, make your last harvest of the year in June, and at that point, cut all the asparagus back to the ground. Every single stalk that's above ground, cut just below the surface. And then go out immediately at that point and spot treat with Roundup. You can do that and get away with it. And so if you have something that's really, really difficult to control, like maybe quack grass or something else of that nature, you can do that. Otherwise, it's typically hoeing and pulling.
Okay, okay. So you're not really, you don't really buy into the salt idea being that the way to go or anything?
No, because like I said, if you apply enough of it, it's going to actually damage the asparagus. And when you travel down the highway, along the road, you still have weeds. There are weeds that are salt tolerant too. So it doesn't necessarily get rid of the weeds, the salt.
All right, Dale, thanks for your call. Next up, Mary Jane on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Mary Jane.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a Norwegian or Norway pine, I think it is, and I have about 5 stems in a 11.5 wide by 9-inch deep pot, and it starts from the bottom, and it's almost to the top branches. All the needles on the ends are turning brown, and I didn't know if it was a water situation or an overcrowding or what.
This is a house plant?
Yeah, you buy them usually at Christmas time, and they're little, and this is an 8-year-old plant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the needles, you know, they spoke out from the stem.
Okay. Is it a Norfolk Island pine, possibly?
Yeah, that's probably what it is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, they like good, consistent care, and if the environment is poor or if the care is rather inconsistent, they will show signs of browning on those. And oftentimes what happens is the lower tier of branches will typically turn brown and they'll eventually fall off.
Yes.
So the key there as far as the care is to give them bright light. They don't need direct sun, but they do need bright light. They should be very close to a window. And water the plant well when you do so. Water should come out the bottom of the pot. Discard the excess water, and then water the plant again when the soil surface becomes dry to the touch.
Mm-hmm.
Winter can be a very tough time for the Norfolk Island pine because the air indoors typically is very, very dry. They don't like that.
Okay.
What you can do is maybe get a large tray or saucer, put some pea gravel in the bottom of the tray or saucer, then add some water, and then place your pot, your Norfolk Island pine, in that saucer or tray, making sure the water level is below the pot. That way, in the winter months, you have the water evaporating from the tray or saucer, which is going to raise the humidity around the plant, and that might help.
Okay. The pot that I have them in is attached, but, you know, the water flow can come up, so It is around it, but it's not separate.
And how long has it been in that container?
8 years.
It's time to replant. Typically, most plants, house plants, we repot every 2 or 3 years. And so I would get a slightly bigger pot, maybe a different type of pot, and repot it as soon as possible.
And I hate to admit this, but I trimmed the brown off once. And it's still growing, so I hope I didn't damage my plant.
Well, only time will tell, but I think I would try to repot it if you can, maybe in the next month or so.
All right, Mary Jane, good luck with that. And next up, we've got David on the line in Iowa City. Hi, David.
Hi there.
What's your question?
I have a ginkgo tree that I planted about 3 years ago, and it was about 3 foot tall at that time, and it's survived, and it's now probably 8 or 9 feet tall. And I'd like to trim the lower little branches off of it, and I'm wondering if I need to do that at a certain time of the year or advice on that.
Well, the ginkgo is a notoriously slow-growing tree, so if it's grown that quickly, that's good. I would probably leave the lower branches for another year or two.
Okay.
And that prevents the tree from getting top-heavy. And so maybe not this coming spring, but maybe the following year, going out in March or early April and pruning off the lowest 1 or 2 branches. Then maybe waiting a year and coming back maybe in a couple of years and pruning off 1 or 2 more. And then kind of gradually raise the clearance on the tree.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, David. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we've got Keith on the line in Iowa Falls. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I'm a novice watermelon grower. I have a good crop growing right now. By that, I mean 10 good plants with quite a few melons on them. I've had a couple of them. It's the, I believe, the earliest variety, the Sugar Baby, and I've eaten them, and they've been ripe. But I'm really questioning if I know what I'm doing as far as ripeness. What are the hints there to tell me when they're ripe?
Right. Well, some people use the thump test with their knuckles. I'm not good at that. I can't tell the difference. So I don't use that.
Well, I mean, what do you? I mean, I've done some reading on this. You listen to a real for a really dull thump rather than a ring. Is that?
Yeah, right. And I can't really tell the difference. I can't, and many people can't. It's very difficult. What I do is I look at the belly,
right?
The portion resting on the ground. To me, that's a very clear signal.
Okay.
That when they're immature, the belly is kind of a greenish white.
Mm-hmm.
When they're ripe, it's kind of a creamy yellow.
Okay.
There is a definite difference, visual difference.
Okay.
And to me, that's far easier than the thump. I just
right.
can't tell the difference.
Okay, yeah. Obviously, the belly is white at first, mm-hmm. and as it matures, it starts to turn yellow.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
it becomes a nice creamy yellow color, yes.
Now,
and that's more pronounced on those that have a dark green skin. On those that are striped or maybe a light color, maybe not as pronounced, but especially on the dark green ones, it's very, very easy to tell.
Okay. Now, when you say creamy yellow, I mean, should you wait for it to really be yellow or?
No, it kind of depends upon the variety, but it's definitely not that greenish white anymore.
Okay.
It's a creamy color. Sometimes it may be a creamy yellow, darker than others, but definitely creamy colored, not greenish white.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Keith. And let's see if we can get in a couple of email questions. This one's for you, Donald, from Ellen. I've observed a shortage of butterflies this summer. I always plant parsley for swallowtails, and so far, not a single caterpillar. Is something going on with butterflies?
Well, butterflies in general have suffered over the 2 decades, I suppose, or more for lack of habitat, that the prairies that we plowed under, the fence rows that we no longer have, the roadsides that are not quite as wild as they used to be. So in general, butterfly populations have declined because of lack of habitat. This specific year, we started out with this huge flock of red admirals. The monarchs were the earliest they had ever been. Hit 90 degrees, hit 100 degrees, stayed 100 degrees for a few days. The butterflies seem to suffer and disappear as well. I think a long-term trend followed by the short-term interruption in normal weather has resulted in fewer butterflies for all of us. I agree with the observation, though.
All right, Donald, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Richard Giron, thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Horticulturist Richard Giron with Iowa State University Extension. And, of course, we will be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support from Jason Burns in Ames today. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, a conversation with Carol Englehart. He's the author of The Farm at Holstein Dip, an Iowa Boyhood. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.